Okay. Well, I guess in some ways I represent the closest thing to institutional public art practice, I guess. I'm the curator at Creative Time in New York, which is a public art organization, at least we define ourselves as such, that was founded in 1973 by a group of artists and has gone through a number of, I would say, different phases over the 32 years we've been in existence. And rather than sort of dwell on, I guess, the structures of how we do our work, which perhaps is something we can talk about later on, I'm just going to try and give an overview of our projects, not entirely representative, but hopefully interesting. And then concluding, actually, with a show that we just did that opened 3 weeks ago, which, in fact, is not outdoors. It's more like a gallery show. We'll get to that. Besides sort of representing, I think, the organizational, or I guess the most organizational position of public art practice, in an institutional context, I think in some ways here, I also represent probably the least instrumentalist approach to art making in the public domain. And it was very interesting for me to watch and listen to everyone else's presentations here, many of whom are pursuing strategies that are looking at very specific kinds of uses of art and of art practice and of artists, either in interventionist types of strategies or, in APG's case, in specific kinds of residencies that look to integrate the artists in a very specific decision-making way into the fabric of society. I would say that while Creative Time lauds and is in favor of those broader goals, you'll see that most of our work is primarily about what artists want to do in the public space and trying to find a way to protect as much room for them to pursue those projects as closely as they can to their original intention and interest. So the first slide that's up here actually is a picture of Ed Koch, who was the mayor of New York some time ago. And he's holding the keys to the city that were actually part of a project that an artist named Red Grooms did, which was called Ruckus Manhattan. Early on Creative Time, I guess I should start off by saying, for those of you who aren't familiar with the history of New York in the 1970s when the organization was founded, the city was in a bit of an economic crisis. There were a lot of cheap places around the city, often derelict buildings. The work of artists like Robert Smithson and Gordon Meta Clark date from this period and have a lot to do with the kind of urban ruin that characterized a lot of New York. So Creative Time was founded in this period when a lot of other, what we call alternative arts organizations, were founded. White Columns, Artist Space, Art in General, many of which are still in existence today, in a desire to step outside of the mainstream gallery institutional structure. In our case, that meant into the public domain, except when we sort of were transient among different, often abandoned storefronts or vacant storefronts where we would negotiate for artists to create projects in full view of passersby. So very early on, the organization was interested in setting up a kind of dialogue, albeit one separated by a pane of glass, between the public and art-making practice. And in this case, Red Grooms made a whole project basically building a rather theatrical, somewhat cartoon-like version of the city that people could come in and walk around it. In the 80s and early 90s, the organization was very involved in explicitly political work, in part because that was the kind of work that that the field was favoring and interested in that period. This is a project that most people don't realize is ours in the U.S., which was a bus poster campaign by the collective called Grand Fury, which was an AIDS activist campaign, which now is in the Library of Congress. Although it's probably hard to make out on this slide, this is the Lower East Side of New York, which is a neighborhood that still has a lot of immigrants there. The city's changing very rapidly. And this was a project done by an artist named Shimon Atti, where he went around and spoke with immigrants, largely Jewish, about their memories and reminiscences, and basically translated them into lasers and projected them onto the community's buildings. So we went into people's apartments and convinced them to let us put a large laser projector in their bedrooms pointing out across the street. And I think that's still very much how we see the value and meaning of our work, is negotiating for artists a safe space within which to operate in the world, and in particular, a respectful position for them within society, which at least in the U.S. has often been characterized, at least in the last 10 years or so, by somewhat skeptical feelings, but certainly on the part of the government and others, about the value of artists within the larger fabric of society, evidenced by the culture wars and the relative cessation of government funding for the arts. Creative Time also took advantage of this somewhat derelict nature of the city during that time period to begin anticipating development in some way and arriving on the scene before it began, often just before it began. And one place where we did projects that people started to recognize before was in Times Square, before it sort of, when it was still sex shops and somewhat seedy before it became the Times Square that people know it as today, the sort of media center of the world, as they like to call it. This is a project by a designer named Seymour Common and Scott Stowell. It was part of a project that we did in 1993-1994 called Times Square Art Project. Also part of that project was in the foreground. There's a sculpture that's part of the project in the background, what I'm trying to draw attention to is Jenny Holzer's theater marquees, which we did in often abandoned theaters around there. And it's interesting because then last year, right before the election, we worked with Jenny again to do her first xenon projections in the United States, which was very interesting for us to learn. She'd never done them in the U.S. before. She'd done them all over the world. And she desperately wanted to get this project out into the world in the lead up to the election, which of course we lost. But at that point, there was still hope, and there certainly was outrage. And what she was interested to do was actually not do truisms that she'd become known for, but in fact project poetry that dealt with torture and violence and other kinds of somewhat sublimated political ideologies. And what you see here is a projection on the facade of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine uptown. At the same time that was happening, we were also flying airplane banners up and down the Hudson River of her truisms, as well as combinations of other new phrases that she'd taken from people like Abraham Lincoln. And so what you see here is a view from another plane of abuse of power, comes as no surprise, one of her more famous truisms. The skies have often been a place that we've done a number of significant projects. This is a project by Vicky Nies, who's a Brazilian photographer primarily. It was very simple. Victor said, I want to do a skywriting project and draw a cartoon cloud in the sky. And this was a very interesting project for us to do because we got a lot of letters about it after the New York Times reported on the project and explained what it was. There was one guy who's a season ticket holder at Yankee Stadium, a rich businessman who died very suddenly, and his family was driving up to the funeral north of the city and saw this and thought it was a baseball match. He thought it was actually a sign from their dead son that everything was okay. And instead of being angry with us when they found out that it wasn't a miracle, they were actually very, very, very pleased. We also get hate mail. I mean, that's one thing that we know for sure, is that putting something in the public domain, there are people who absolutely love it more than even you do as a presenter, and there are people who absolutely hate it. We've also done more interventionist type projects over the years, often dealing with issues that we think are worthy of discussion. At the time when a lot of the genome sequence was wrapping up, we did a project that was called DNA. And what you see here is that we commissioned a series of coffee deli cups that were distributed in delis around the city. And this is, these are Terry Leibowitz. We also, I guess I should also say that we understand our work as a dynamic conversation between essentially three entities. It's probably the closest I'll come to discussing structural issues, but the artist, the site, and the audience, which is somewhat simplistic, but the key to the way we work is, for us, the relative flexibility and latitude that we give ourselves in defining those terms. And we're happy to sort of start anywhere along this circular conversation. But most of the time, you start with an artist. Artist has a particular idea, and then we try and bring them to the right sites or the right audiences that we feel will best inform the work. Sometimes, however, people come to us with a site, or the site's already there, and we think it's interesting enough to bring artists to it, because sometimes the kind of audience that it creates. In this case, these are two pictures. On the left is a still of the official advice piece that we did on the Panasonic screen in Times Square, where we have an ongoing relationship going on for 4 years now, where they give us the final minute of each hour on the screen, almost 24 hours a day, except when the news is playing. And so at any given time, we have a piece up there for about 3 month intervals. On the right is William Kentridge. And it's the only site where we actually program. Everything else that we do, we negotiate the site on a project by project basis. This is Takashi Murakami's first public project in the US, which is in Grand Central Station. This was an incredibly ambitious project that opened a lot of issues with success and failure for us, which are always things we try and contend with, not always successfully, by a Chinese artist named Cai Guocheng, which is in Central Park. This is over the reservoir in Central Park. And it was a 5-minute fireworks event that cost an enormous amount of money, thankfully paid for by Haagen-Dazs. And the occasion was to celebrate the park's 150th birthday. And what he wanted to do was to draw a huge circle over the reservoir. This was sort of the main element of the 5-minute sequence. And we worked with the oldest fireworks company in the country, which is outside of New York, and they developed a proprietary technology with microchips in each shell that would allow the artist to reasonably precisely control the altitude and position of the shells firing, and therefore allow them to somewhat draw in the sky. Of course, it turns out to not be a terribly accurate technology, and so we were in the odd position of having generated an enormous amount of press using a rendering that the artist had drawn, which looked very, very specific and pretty. And as you can sort of tell, the weather was really awful that evening, and it poured as soon as we finished. And so we had a lot of disappointed people in the crowd from the papers the next day around Fizzle Works and all these sort of hilarious things. And we got some hate mail over this because it was the week of September 11th, and the sound was really remarkable. We set off something like, I don't know, 16,000 shells in 30 seconds to draw this. And Central Park, those of you who know New York, is lined essentially with reasonably tall buildings on the other side, so it created a sound echo corridor. And the newspaper found some old ladies on the Upper West Side who were cowering in their closets thinking that the city was under attack. And sure enough, other people I know who were flying into JFK could hear it from the airplane. Unfortunately, I was quoted in the paper saying, "Oh, I thought the sound was remarkable." these things happen. Last year, during the Republican National Convention, for a long time, been trying to grapple with the political history of the organization. And even though artists, a lot of leading artists are no longer as explicitly working with political ideologies in the ways they once were, we still are feeling a responsibility towards that, increasingly so in the current political climate in the US. And so this is a piece called the Freedom of Expression National Monument, which dates from 1984. When we did it the first time, it was pointed at the reasonably newly constructed World Trade Center, so people could get up there and scream at the trade centers. But in this case, we erected a downtown pointing at government buildings so that during the RNC, people could go up and use it 24 hours a day to shout at the edifices of power. And it was actually quite well received, which surprised me. Every time we do a politically oriented project, it surprises me how vitally interested people are, I think, in finding those kinds of outlets, particularly when we're living in a time where it's acceptable for the president's spokesman to say after 9/11 people should watch what they say. So freedom of expression in the United States is a very important aspect of what we do, and we're often finding ourselves in positions advocating for First Amendment rights Earlier this year, we were tipped off that the Parks Department was actually trying to pass a statute very quietly that would ban all religious, sexual, and political public art in city parks. And this was just drawn up by an internal lawyer who really hadn't consulted with anybody and just thought it was a good thing to do. And so there, you know, we had to go and fight City Hall on that, which very quickly City Hall recommended it wasn't a good thing to do. But this is often the context of public art making in the United States and the way that culture works. We're probably best known and also least known for this project we did downtown after September 11th, which was a memorial project called Tribute in Light, which is a longer story I won't go into here. The interesting thing about this project, which of course was reproduced on many, many newspapers all around the world, is that, and now the city actually does this, remounts the project every September 11th without our involvement and without the artist's involvement. The piece never really sort of was understood in its critical context. The two artists on the team who conceived the project had a very fascist interest in their original conception that most people don't get, but I think it's ever more relevant within the discussion of the aftermath of that particular attack. Periodically, we do organize multi-artist projects, which seem to deal interestingly to us with sites that are interesting or public issues that are interesting. In this case, this is a project that was conceived by a somewhat famous now ex-graffiti artist named Steve Powers, who came to us and said that he was hanging around in Coney Island, which is kind of like Tivoli, except much more run down, and located on the beach in Brooklyn. And he went down there because he works a lot with lettering. He wanted to see how some of the signs down at Coney Island, which many of which were hand-painted, could inspire his own work. And he realized that a lot of the businesses down there didn't have any signs. And so he said, oh, well, wouldn't it be great to try and paint some signs for businesses? And so he went down there and convinced the owners of the El Dorado Arcade to let him paint El Dorado over their back, very begrudgingly on that. And so we blew that up into a 25-artist project that took advantage of Coney Island's particular audience, which during the day is largely black and Hispanic. Periodically, when there's concerts or something down there, the hipster Manhattan audience, largely white, shows up just sort of for the event. Most of them don't actually play the games because they don't care so much about winning little teddy bears. And actually, the community has a somewhat begrudging relationship to the somewhat wealthier clientele that come to the area because they don't buy corn dogs. They come down with their wheat grass, and you know that they don't end up spending money there. So we found ourselves in a very interesting position of showing up and saying, here's the deal: you want to give artists as much freedom to do what they want as possible, but in exchange, you get a free sign. And that, to me, seemed like a great deal, but of course, that's sort of like someone coming into your house and saying, hey, you got a blank wall, and I've got a really famous artist, and we're going to give you a great painting, but you don't get to pick it. And not surprisingly, a number of the businesses actually sort of rebelled once the pieces were up there, but they're still there for the most part. But Coney Island, which was once called the Playground for the People, has a way of collapsing both high and low culture in a really great way, and that was something we tried to take advantage of in the same way it collapses different kinds of socioeconomic audiences. So a number of the artists that I organized, well, unfortunately I don't have images here, are design record covers or graphic designers. Others of them are more sort of traditional galleries, studio painters. In this case, the store, or the original amusement was supposed to be a dime toss, and this is a sign created by Colin Grinnell. The problem is the dime toss never actually opened, and the owner didn't have enough money to do it, so he had to put another game in called Skin the Wire, which was supposed to be further down. That's a painting done by Nicole Eisenman. And so we were in the odd position of having to mount the two of them together, which is kind of funny. The piece that I think best speaks to the context of the whole show is done by Jack Pearson over an empty storefront or empty booth, which you can't see here, but it's created of tons of little sequins that sort of flitter in the wind and create a nice and a fantastical glittery context that gets at this sort of tomorrow Disney World will come up and buy out all of us and we'll retire to Florida, which never seems to happen in 2011. The last project which I'm going to talk about and try to do so quickly because I know I'm inspired is a project that I organized recently that's about a major urban redevelopment project on the west side of New York that's called the High Line, which we're seeing here looking north from the Meatpacking District up to the Gallery District on the left, which also happens to be the building a bit further up is where the Homeland Security offices are in New York. And essentially, this is a commercial rail line that was in use until 1980. And it was built about 80 years ago, and a number of buildings were constructed around it to allow trains to load and unload their goods into buildings around it, many of which were meatpacking buildings. But since the last train ran on it in 1980, all of these weeds have just taken root up there rather naturally. And some of them, as you can see, are as big as trees. A few years ago, actually 5 years ago, it was destined to be knocked down and destroyed, but a community preservation movement started and is basically keeping it and turning it into a public park. So last year there was a high-profile design competition with Zaha Hadid and Hilary Scafidio and a number of other interesting people, and we were involved as, cultural programming consultant on those design teams. In the course of working on that, which has generated a lot of press since then and is about to sort of start its groundbreaking, it became clear some of the central paradoxes at the core of the line's redevelopment, which is that it's the inaccessible space that runs about two stories over your head. If any of you have walked around galleries in Chelsea, New York, you've walked under it, you probably haven't even noticed it. And the great thing about it is it's been romanticized by the photographer Joel Sternfeld took a lot of pictures up there that were widely circulated a few years ago that made it look really beautiful, and it is. But for engineering reasons, all of the plants have to be ripped up in order for the space to become accessible. As such, it plays out this very American kind of romance and at the same time destruction of our landscape and wilderness. And rather than wait for the line to become accessible to do projects up there, and artists have been coming to us for years looking to do projects in this space, it seemed like actually what we would do is take advantage of this pitched moment before the redevelopment starts and look at the ways in which we conceive of spaces we can't get to. And how, in many cases, the nostalgia for something that's not yet gone informs and tinges our present experience of them in a kind of melancholic way. It just so happened that at the southern end of the line, the building where I'm standing on the roof of taking this picture, is a vacant meatpacking warehouse that's probably going to be destroyed this fall to make way for a new a museum, which some of you may know, the Diaz Center for the Arts, is hoping to buy this particular building and destroy it and turn it into a new museum. So it seemed like the right kind of environment to locate a show like this. So this is sort of a view of one of the interior scenes. There's still some dried blood on the floor, which is kind of fascinating. A lot of it are empty freezer rooms that provide kind of hermetic sorts of spaces that are very well insulated, lend themselves well to video and sound. And just to get a sense, bear with me one second, I have a little video that gives you a better sense of the space inside of it. So the show is called The Plain of Heaven, and it's located in the State Meatpacking Warehouse, and it includes 14 artists whose work considered the variety of themes that stem from this transitional moment. And the first piece we actually find as we walk through the truck bay, which is what we're looking at now, which is sort of the entry point to the entire building, is by an artist named Paul Ramirez Jonas, which is a water tank set to drain exactly over the run of the show, marking its own disappearance. It's his version of a Roman water clock. And on a nearby wall, he placed a small unfired clay tablet into which he's typed the source code for the oldest web page online. Across the way is Cory McCorkle's film of his pilgrimage to Cambodia to find a mystical town named Priya. And though the trash and meat hooks still hang overhead, the building was last used as a poultry warehouse. These are photographs by Shannon Edner, which shot on the roof of the building. The images say exit and glacier, referring to a rapidly receding glacier of the same name in Alaska and are free to be taken as posters. Song Dong's video of burning photographs depicts the artist in various tourist sites around the world, concluding at the High Line itself. And it runs in slow motion and in reverse so that the flames actually seem to be constituting the image, getting into kind of themes of creation through destruction. This is a Gordon Matta Clark film from 1975 documenting his cutting of a warehouse on the river one block from the show called Days End. And the city discovered what Matta Clark had done and actually locked the building up, so this illegal sculpture ended up never really being seen by the public. When we reach the top floor of the building, there's a large painting by Adam Stefanovich, which is a mural of the Union Pacific Railroad crossing the Continental Divide, and his rails actually recede in parallel to the High Line outside. Nearby, Saul Lewitz made a new wall drawing, which includes directions for its execution, and a drawing from 1970 on the facing wall, which consists of blue chalk lines snapped between all the architectural points of the surface. We passed through Leandro Ehrlich's illusory installation of doors with keyholes that seem to lead to a brightly lighted room, but instead we find another dark room, which then leads us to Saskia Oldwolver's video, in which we move through a fantastical underwater landscape that she's created meticulously by hand in little kiddie pools in her London studio. And in a room facing the High Line, viewers can hear a field recording from the 1950s of a freight train making its way up a mountain at night, done by the photographer O. Winston Link, who was famous for his images of the last functioning steam engines. Helen Mira has made a sound installation in a huge unlighted refrigeration room that uses bass harmonica, mouth harp, and whistling to take advantage of the space's acoustics. Unfortunately, I can't play that, but. And nearby in an old smoke room that was used to smoke the meat, Adam Putnam has created a video of successively receding rooms, which create a kind of light tunnel, giving viewers a way out of one of the building's darker recesses. One of the more interesting things for me personally to work on with this show was a piece with the American choreographer William Forsythe, who directed the Ballet Frankfurt for 20 years. He choreographed the work in collaboration with a dancer in an enormous skylighted room on this top floor, which is about 150 feet long. And the dancer, named Brock LeBrenz, weaves among and interacts with a field of these hanging plumb bobs in an improvisational meditation that he performs each day for 6 hours at a time. And during the last 20 minutes of the show in 2 weeks, Tricia Donnelly has created a sound work which is only going to be played once, emanating from speakers in the heart of the building. The organ music winds its way through the structure, elegizing the condemned warehouse, the work itself, and the entire show before each fully disappears. So just before closing, there's a couple other pictures. So I know there's a lot of information if people want to talk to me afterwards. These are Solowitz assistants executing the drawing. There's Paul Ramirez Jones trying to figure out how to get the water drain exactly right. There's a bigger picture of Adams that gives you a sense of the space around him. It's Matta Clark's film and the projector. Leandro Ehrlich's doors. And the larger room within which the William Forsythe piece was located. So, anyway, thanks very much for being so patient.